Healthy relationships with teenagers. As you may or may not realize, I am not the parent of teenagers. My wife and I do not have any children, and if we did have children, it would be quite a while before I'd be the parent of teenagers. However, I've been in youth work for the last 12 years and have worked at the same church, not only with my own parents, but also with literally hundreds of other parents and teenagers, and have had some good opportunities, some not so good opportunities to observe what seems to work and doesn't work in the families of teenagers. Let me start by saying a word to those of you who are parents. With almost no exception of cases that I know of, I can say that you are the ones who make the difference. In a book review in Christianity Today, Tim Stafford of the Youth for Christ organization was talking about two new books out, one by Jay Kessler called Parents and Teenagers, another book, secular book on Adama Press, A-D-A-M-A Press, called Teenagers Themselves. And as he was concluding his study of those two books and what's happening in the teenage world, he said these words, "A life well lived is still the best tool for building effective teenagers." A life well lived. Talking to you, the parents, a life well lived. To use a discipleship phrase, more things are caught than are taught. Your kids, believe it or not, will turn out like you. Most of them will have similar values, similar attitudes, and perhaps similar life goals and jobs. That's a good news, bad news story. The good news is maybe you're not losing ground like you thought you were. The bad news is they might turn out like you. You know, and you look at them, and one of the hard things about being a parent, and I should say this with youth work and as a youth worker, is you start seeing yourself in the kids that you're producing. And not everything you see is good. Some of it is like looking in the mirror when you're ready, you know, for a big night out, and you're sort of all ready, and you say, "Hey, great, I love seeing that in my kid." And others is like getting up on a Saturday morning and you look in the mirror and that's what your kid looks like, you know, and you say, "Oh no, how could it ever happen?" And then you see the quality or the negative quality in them that actually you think it might be in you as well. Being the parent of a teenager, being relating to teenagers, whether you're the youth leader or a parent, is a great challenge. And all of us would love to have the pat solution. Like last night, somebody was talking, maybe Charlie Riggs, you know, we would like to have the pills that we could take. You know, and I'd love to be able to give you the pills, you know, this is the communication with teenagers pill. You take this and you and your kids will talk fluently all the time. I mean, I'd make $1 million at this conference just trying to help parents. Unfortunately, there are no guaranteed solutions. Mark Twain is credited with the humorous story of his guaranteed solution of working with teenagers. He said the best way to help a kid through his teen years is at age 13, put him in a large rain barrel, nail the top shut, and drill a hole through so that you can feed them through a straw and let them breathe. He said then, at age 16, plug up the hole. And a lot of you as parents, some of you as youth workers, you might be at the point where you want to plug up the hole. There are things that you will see produced in your kids that maybe you don't like so much and you'd like to plug up the hole. They will say things to you that you will say to yourself, where did they ever get a thought like that? How could they ever say something like that? Or on the most negative side, sometimes your kids will say things to you that will cause you incredible pain. Teenagers are growing in terms of their adult maturity. And sometimes their minds and their mouths are far ahead of their life experience. And they're able to think things and say things that they have no concept of how painful it is to you, the parent, that they're saying it. And teenagers are sinners. I don't know if I had to tell you that. But I will probably talk later on about the fact that parents of teenagers are sinners too, which sometimes we do forget. But teenagers are sinners, able to manipulate parents, able to hurt them, and able to say, you know, they know you almost as well as you know them. And they know where your Achilles' heels are. You know, and they go right after that sometimes. We were talking in one of the question and answer times last evening. One parent was asking the question about, should I allow my daughter to do something? And the daughter was basically coming back with, don't you trust me? Don't you really have confidence in me? And what the daughter knew was that was the mother's button, the vulnerable button. The mother said, oh, I'm feeling guilty. My daughter doesn't think that I trust her. Maybe the mother would be wiser to say, no, I don't. I don't trust you because you're too young, immature, or something like that. A great challenge of being the parent of a teenager. Yet, both secular and Christian books, literature, are telling us over and over again that in the fundamentally basic home, be it single parent or dual parent, is showing us that parents are the ones who are affecting their kids. There is a period of time where it seems like the peers are more influential. There's a period of time where it might be a coach or even a youth worker, a church that might seem more influential, but it's the parent that has the greatest long-term effect. Key qualities. You'll notice that I'm not going to give you 5 steps or 6 easy solutions or 35 guidelines. I'm just trying to give 5 qualities that I think I have observed in family situations where parents and teenagers are relating pretty well. There is no situation that I know of where there are no problems. I was listening to Gene talking about his having a 12-year-old son, I think he said he had. And, if you don't want the kid to go, just say no, don't let him go. Well, that is true. You need to hold your line like that. However, Gene didn't fill you in on everything else that might follow. It's not always, it's not like the kid's going to, oh, yes, father, and then go to his room. What do you do that evening when you walk out the door and your kid's letting himself down by the bedroom sheets out of his window so that he can still go even though you said no? And that sometimes can happen. Maybe not quite that drastic, but it is a challenge. 5 qualities, though, that I think are necessary in terms of building healthy relationships. Qualities that maybe you'll walk out of this seminar and take one of them and start implementing it. Maybe you'll realize, hey, I really haven't done that. I have to make a decision of my own will to start doing it. Because even though teenagers have lots of problems and lots of things that they have to grow out of, you, the parent, do have a lot of what I might call trump cards, the ability to make some decisions and direct positively the family situation. Envision this situation. A mother and her son are at the supermarket. They're walking out of the supermarket. Mother somehow has 4 bundles. Son has managed to have no bundles. Okay? As you're walking out of the supermarket, mother stumbles, drops one of the bundles all over the parking lot. The son turns to that mother and says, oh, Ma, you are such a klutz. Another situation. Father is teaching high school Sunday school class. It's getting more and more disruptive. And the thing that drives the father crazy is he knows the disruption is coming from his own teenage daughter in the back row. I don't get no respect. Parents will oftentimes feel like the Rodney Dangerfields of their own home. I don't get no respect. The kid that you have brought up, that you conceived and brought through the 9 months of pregnancy and then delivered into the world from infant, helpless little infant, now is 12, 13, 14 years old and starting to really aggravate you, not respect you. You say to in your own mind, maybe you say it directly to your kids, they owe me everything. We have pet rabbits. And this is an example. We have pet rabbits, and one of the rabbits has a real ornery personality. We leave him out in the backyard in the cage. And that rabbit, when picked up, will kick, will squeal, and actually one person was taking care of the rabbit for us, and he kicked and actually scratched her eye, her retina in her eye. And there is part of me that wants to pick up that rabbit, wring the neck, and just say, no, what a no good thing. The rabbit could not make it in the wild without now because it's a domestic rabbit, and everything, water, food, shelter, you know, the warmth, the little house that we built, is all because of us. And the way that I feel towards that rabbit, sometimes the way that you as parents will feel towards your kids when they start giving you flack. You know, you want to just pick them up, you know. I mean, now I'm going to make a statement that's a little bit drastic here, but I think you'll understand what I mean. Very few parents that I work with abuse their children, physically or even emotionally. Very few parents I work with have a difficult time, however, understanding those who do. Do you get what I'm saying? If you are a parent and have any degree of feeling with the degree of intensity and anger that you can feel towards your own kid, maybe you'll understand why somebody punches out their son or daughter. You know, it's like the time, I think it was Ruth Graham was credited with saying this, that she was asked about her relationship with Billy and whether or not she ever thought, she said, you know, Ruth, have you ever thought about divorce? And Ruth said, oh no, divorce? Never. Murder, maybe. You know? I mean, maybe you've never entertained the idea of, you know, sending your kid off to a state hospital. But killing them, yeah, you've thought about that, you know? Well, especially it's true when the teenagers become a little bit perceptive and they say, you know, you don't even want me around. Sometimes you have to, you know, so you don't say, you're right, I don't want you around. Respect. You don't get no respect. But as a radical opposition to what you think, I might say, I'd like to just suggest that the best way to start building respect in your home is to respect your teenagers. You, the parent, to start respecting your teenagers. And if you're a youth worker, to respect the kids in your group. What do I mean by that? Let me give you a definition, a simple one. I don't think you'll be able to jot it all down, but you can at least hear it out. Belief that your teenager is a human being, precious in God's sight, capable of thinking, in need of my coaching. Four things to think about there. First, you believe that your teenager is a human being. Now, that sounds, of course I believe my teenager is a human being. Sometimes, either by the bad press the teenagers get, or by the over degree of focusing on adolescence as a phenomena, sometimes we think that teenagers are something other than human. You know, like the TV show V, you know, we think that if we peeled their skin away, there'd be a lizard underneath, you know. And we have this image, you know, your kid. You know, the best way I can summarize it is when people come to me at church and say, you work with teenagers? As if to say teenagers are some sort of, you know, unusual species. I feel like saying, you know, excuse me, weren't you a teenager once? Oh, no, but not like these kids. Teenagers are human beings. They are growing into adulthood. And we in our culture have almost created an impossible situation where they are neither children nor adults. Remember this, and this is an observation of a psychologist or sociologist who works down at Asbury Seminary and College. He said that adolescence is, relatively speaking, an invention of modern civilization. Just recently, in the month of March, I had the opportunity to be in a few third world countries. And the kids there are usually not adolescents in the sense that ours are. They don't have this long period. When they get to be 12, 13, 14, they start thinking about adult responsibilities. They start taking care of the whole family sometimes. Well, we have this long period from age 10, 11, 12 to sometimes age 30. Really? Where kids are dependent still on their parents. They haven't flown the coop. And maybe it's not such a good idea. Belief that they're human beings, precious in God's sight. Precious in God's sight. I say that because if you're going to have some degree of composure and love as parents, you have to remember how God looks at your kids. This morning's talk was a good one. The value of the individual. There are going to be times when you might have despair about your kids, seeing no hope at all. But God sees them as precious. Because Jesus Christ died for your teenager just as much as he died for you. Precious in God's sight. I say that because, again, there are going to be times when you might forget that fact and need to have God's perspective sort of reminded upon you. Third thing, capable of thinking. One of the things that I will say to parents when we start dealing with some of the problems that they're having at home, is this. When you train up your children to make their own decisions, sometimes they do. And that's a good mark of good parenting. What's hard is they don't always make the decision that you want them to. See, the idea is not to create clones. The idea is to create mature adults. And if that's going to happen, they have to make some of their own decisions. You have to respect their ability to think, even if it's a little bit immature, even if it's irrational. But you have to be willing to say, this is the way my kid's thinking. And you have to understand that. Don't call your kids airheads. That will stick in their minds, even if it's a flippant sort of a joking remark. They are capable of thinking, and if you've done a good job as parents, they're going to want to start breaking away, to make their own decisions, to create, in a sense, their own sense of identity in life. Fourth thing, they are in need of your coaching. And the word coaching is carefully chosen. They need your coaching. They don't necessarily need your military dictatorship. They don't necessarily need you to be the one who sets all the rules and makes all the decisions for them. To use a coaching terminology, you need to encourage them on how to play the game, and sometimes you need to let them call their own plays. And when they come back to the sidelines, you need to say, hey, maybe we could have done this better or that better, but you've got to let them go out there on the field alone. And that's why I use the word coaching. Well, just a few things about building respect. The two things that I will just highlight today is, number one, if you're going to let your kids know that you respect them, number one, take their lives seriously. Take their lives seriously. It's easy for us who are in the adult world, who are handling all sorts of responsibilities, it's easy for us to think, that's just a kid stuff. A situation happened that I was told by one of our junior high girls, I was told by the girl when she was in senior high. She came home to her mother and told her of her first love. She was in seventh grade, and her first love, an eighth grade boy, was something she revealed to her mother. That's a good sign that she would even open that up to her mother. However, she walked into the house a little bit later on, and her mother was on the phone to her friend, and she overheard her mother say these words. Oh, Amy came home today with her first puppy love. Isn't it so cute? Now, to that teenage girl, trust, respect, has been washed away. Because to that teenager, age 13 or 14, that puppy love might be the most important thing in the world. And to diminish it as being cute is to say, you know, your life is just sort of insignificant. You know, when your kid is having a crisis, don't underestimate how serious it is to them. You might have outgrown it, but you're older. You've had more shots at life than they have. You know, you might say to yourself, what are you having such a breakdown about? I mean, you want to stay home from school because you got a pimple right here? Maybe they do. Now, I'm not saying you should let them stay home from school, but at least you'd give them some paint or something, you know, I mean, help them cover it over. But let them know that you understand how intense it is for them. Take their lives seriously. And related to that, you know, is the whole matter of listening to them, understanding the signals when they're telling you something that's heavy. Take their lives. And that's very difficult. It's very selfless on behalf of the parent because there's not a lot in it for you. If anything, you're going to have to be careful not to, you know, let the corners of your lips go up in a little smile because you think it is cute. You know, or it's just like you read about in the books that this was going to happen. You know, you've got to, oh, really? You know, and, you know, failing that spelling test at school could be the crisis of life. You know, letting them, having a girl or a boy not like them anymore. You know that they're probably not going to marry that kid, but they don't know that. Take their life seriously. The second thing I would say is to be able to understand their world. It's sort of related to that first one. Understand the world out of which they are coming. If you care about their world, then you communicate to them that you respect the fact that they are in a different place than you are. Let me just give you a suggestion in terms of a practical nature. Some parents will oftentimes ask me this question. How do I get conversation started with my kids? First of all, let me tell you, if you have difficulty with conversation with your kids, you're not unusual. You know, being a youth worker is my profession. I've had teenagers longer than most of you as parents will ever have teenagers. Okay? But as a professional working with youth, I have a hard time talking with high schoolers. I will come in with my list of questions and ask them, you know. They'll, you know, great questions too, I think. You know, and I'll listen up. Yep. Nope. Yep. Nope. You know. So what kind of day did you have at school? Good. You know, any tough tests? Nope. You know. You find any friends there? Yep. You know, and it's actually great, especially talking with high school guys on the phone. I mean, I can almost guarantee it's going to be 27 seconds, no more, no less. You know. And don't be surprised if you have that problem. But when you are communicating with them, a practical suggestion. There are two books out today, one printed in 1981, another one just not recently, 1984. 1981, Private Life of the American Teenager. Now, bear in mind, these are secular books, so there are going to be things in there that you might, as Christian parents, find offensive, so I apologize in advance. And but it's reality. It's the reality of the teenage world. I mean, if you want to put your blinders on, then it's going to make you that much more challenged in terms of understanding where they are coming from. Sex, drugs, kids' real opinions about whether or not they should save their virginity or not, usually not, stuff like that. You know, swears, I think. Private Life of the American Teenager is a survey of 160,000 teenagers across America, which includes statistical results as well as personal comments. The other book, Private Life of the American Teenager, is published by Rawson Wade. Rawson, R-E-W-S-O-N, /Wade, W-A-D-E. 1981, I think it is. And then the other one is Teenagers Themselves. Teenagers Themselves is published 1984 by Adama Books, A-D-A-M-A Books, in New York. Both of those books create a lot of statistics, and sometimes it's easier to get a conversation started with a teenager if you say, hey, I was reading this book, and in it it says 52% of all junior high guys have had their first experience of being drunk by the time they're in eighth grade. Do you think that's true? Now, see the way I've asked the question? I haven't asked, have you? Okay? Because that's what, when you read it, that's going to be your first response. You know? I mean, you read the statistic about sexual activity about teenagers, and you think about your darling little princess. And there are boys at the high school campus lusting after my daughter. You know? And you will freak out. So read it first, maybe together as husband and wife, or if you're a single parent with a friend, you know, talk about it together. So try to get a little bit of objectivity, cool down, and then ask, you know, what do you think about that? I do that. That's the best way for me to find out what our high schools are like, because every high school is different. Every junior high is different. And the culture of this junior high, the culture of the high school, can differ from town to town, and even within towns. So knowing where your own kid's coming from lets them know that you care about their lives. Okay? Second thing, responsibility. Jay Kessler, the president of Youth for Christ, wrote these words. If there is one overriding problem that seems to be evident in all people who work with teenagers today, it's not the neglect of parents for their young people, it's the tendency of parents to be overprotective and to keep young people from growing into independence. The truth is, the young person goes away from home and becomes exactly what he is when the props are removed. One of the most basic aspects of the parent relationship is understanding that the task of parenthood is to develop the independence, not dependence, in our children. To rear children towards independence is one of the highest goals of parenthood. If your kids are starting to be independent, don't take it all as a negative sign. You might not like the choices they're making, but they're going to have to understand that life is making their own choices sometimes. Some responsibilities. Responsibility is something that I think should be given gradually and maybe should start even in the preteen years with things like chores around the house, things like keeping your room clean or at least acceptable or at least so you can walk through it. I mean, you have to maybe temper your responsibilities according to the kid. You know, some of the kids are going to just be meticulous instinctively, and other kids are going to be garbage collectors instinctively, and trying to figure out in between the two. Giving them responsibility. One of the saddest cases that I can remember in our youth group was happened with a guy named Peter. Peter grew up in a very rigid Christian home. In all of his teen years, never went to a dance, never went to any social activities at his school. His only outlet outside the church was to be involved in sports, gymnastics. He was never really, as far as I could understand, given the opportunity to make his own decisions. However, by age 18, he had done poorly in school and only got into the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Now, that's where I went to school, so don't laugh too hard about UMass and Amherst. But UMass and Amherst is a big party-oriented or party reputation school. And Pete went to that school because it was the only school he could get into, and it was the only school that would give him a gymnastic scholarship. And you know, when he went to that school, the cork blew off the bottle, and he went wild. You know, and I'm not saying that he shouldn't be responsible for his own behavior, but I'm saying to some degree the parents asked for it. Because, you know, you keep screwing the cork in the bottle tighter and tighter, and the pressure's building in with inside. As soon as the pressure's taken off that cork, man, it's going to be an explosion. And by his sophomore year of college, Peter had to drop out because of his drug dependence. And to this day, I don't know if his parents ever admitted what he was doing. See, because they just couldn't bear to let him go and let him make his own decisions. Well, that's a drastic case. Probably all of us can practice a little bit more preventive maintenance by giving them responsibilities gradually. Let me just suggest six areas that you need to give responsibility in. First one is studies. If your kid is doing poorly in school, don't always go and blame the system. Don't blame the teachers. Don't, you know, until you've investigated the system and until you know your kid. Maybe they haven't been doing their work and you just don't want to come to grips with it. Give them responsibilities for their studies. If your teenager at age 13, 14, 15 is adapting the habit of blaming other people for his or her failure, that's a bad characteristic. Because sometime in life, we have to accept the fact that we are responsible. And if you get brought up in a bad neighborhood and you have a difficult school situation, you still have to do the best with what you've got. Give them responsibility for study. Second thing, give them responsibility for money. Now, I can read you some statistics about teenage America that would probably frighten you. In 1983, 27 million teenagers in the United States spent $45 billion. The primary items were albums, clothes, cosmetics. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, bread and butter, you know. It wasn't necessities in life. Snacks was also in the top five. And, you know, entertainment, movies especially, and concerts. Well, you say to yourself, give my kid responsibility for money? You've got to be kidding. Well, they need to have responsibility for money. A kid in our youth group, sophomore in high school, by the name of Dick, came to register for our winter retreat. And I was amazed. He came in, he registered, and he wrote out a check. You know, at first I thought, oh, brother, he stole one of Mom's checks, you know, and he's writing it out. Then I looked. It has his name, Richard Gabrielson, right on the check. And I said, Dick, what's this? He says, my checking account. And I said, you have your own checking account? And he said, yeah. My parents, they told me they think that I should have a checking account now and manage some money now so that when I go away to college, I don't blow it the whole wad. Good point. I know kids who in college at age 18 have all of a sudden got all this discretionary money at their hand for books, clothes, for the whole semester or the whole year, and sometime around Thanksgiving, you know, the well runs dry because they never learned how to manage money. Joseph Bailey, who is, I think, the president or vice president of Cook Publications, David C. Cook Publications, tells the story in his own family about how as his teenagers were growing up, he gave them more and more responsibility for handling the family books. So by the time, I think he had three teenagers and they were 16, 17, and 18. By the time they were 16, 17, and 18, he would come home, put his check on the table, and the kids were in the house. Now that's a little bit more than some of you might be ready to handle, you know. I know a lot of teenagers don't even know what their fathers or mothers make. You know, but in his situation, now he started early when they were 12 or 13 and worked them up. Now, whatever you say about that, he taught them what it is to manage a house. And you know, we're going to have all these kids growing up knowing how to run computers and knowing how to do all these extra skills, but they won't be able to balance their checkbooks. Give them some responsibility for money. Because I think it's a key area where you can demonstrate your trust in them, your respect for them, but also teach them. It's better for them to bounce some checks when they're in high school than it is for them to get out into the real world and be out of dough. The greatest problem amongst young singles and young couples by ages 20 to 30 is their indebtedness. They overcharge themselves. They're living at 110, 120% of their income because of credit cards. Now, I don't know if you want to give your kid a checking account or a credit card. Can you imagine that? I don't know. Let's not take this too seriously. Number three, you need to give them responsibility for their friends. That book, The Private Life of the American Teenager, says that according to the teenager survey, over 80% of them will see their friends even if their parents disapprove. And because of the high school or junior high environment, you, the parent, are faced with an almost impossible situation. How are you going to forbid them from seeing their friends? Keep them out of school? I mean, you can't. So you need to give them responsibility for their friends. Make them responsible. Don't let them say, hey, my friends were doing it, and I just got caught in the shuffle. Hey, you're responsible. If your friends were shoplifting and you were an accessory and you were picked up, you're responsible. Hold them responsible for the behavior of their friends. If their friends come in and they tear the house up, make the kid pay. If they're going to choose their friends, they've got to be responsible for them. And sometimes it's always a pleasant thing for the parent or the youth worker to have the teenager say, I've got to stop hanging around with those kids. They're a bad influence on me. But it's much wiser and much more freeing if the teenager comes to that decision himself or herself. Now, you've got to offer your coaching and say to them, you know, have you ever thought about this with your friend? And maybe they haven't thought about it. See, your teenagers really do expect you to know a little bit more about life than they do. They don't always express that to you, but they do need your help. And like Gene was saying earlier, they really do need to know the barriers of life. You know, they need to know that this is how far the border goes, because that creates an atmosphere of security in the home. A fourth area where you need to give them responsibility is chores at home. And that's an old-fashioned word, but I think you get the message. A fifth area is you need to give them responsibility in terms of their time. A parent, read this in a book about parenting teenagers. A mother came into her son and the room looked like, you know, Hiroshima after the blast. I mean, it just looked horrible. And the mother said to the son, you know, why haven't you cleaned up your room? Oh, the son said, I just haven't had time. And the mother came back, not to be outdone, with this statement. She said, well, isn't it amazing? And the son said, what? Isn't it amazing that the President of the United States can run the entire country on 168 hours a week, and you can't find the time to clean your room in the same amount of hours? Let them know to be responsible for their time. You know, because, again, it's a skill that they can take with them into life. You are, to use our theme for this weekend, you are the equippers, the disciplers, the investors. And your best potential disciplers are the ones right in your... disciples are the ones right in your own home. And you might need to go listen to the tape again about the value of the individual. And you might lose sight of that they are valuable. But they are the best ones. Give them some responsibility. Finally, and most difficultly, you need to give them responsibility with respect to their spiritual decisions. Respect to their spiritual decisions. One of the big questions that comes, especially to parents of those who are 15, 16, 17 years old, comes to me is, should I force my kid to go to church? or to youth group, or to Sunday school, or something like that, Bible study. I don't know. I don't know the answer because no one situation that I know of works. Let me tell you a story, a true story, about the Borthwick family. Three kids, my sister Susan, myself in the middle, and my brother Scott. All three of us, about age 16, began rebelling and being sort of militantly opposed to the church. My sister, my brother, and myself were all forced to keep on going to church until we were 18. I was forced to go on a Grace Chapel High School youth group, and in 1971, I became a Christian on a Grace Chapel High School youth group that I was forced, our youth retreat that I was forced to go to. But neither my brother nor my sister have come back to the Lord yet. So there's, to me, that's a pretty capsule summary that, you know, you're going to have to just sometimes really just fall on your knees before the Lord and say, what do I do, Lord? Because if you're going to train up your children to make their own decisions, they're going to make their own decisions about the Lord. And they're going to have to, at some point between ages 10 and maybe 20, at some point they have got to make a decision, for you who are Christian parents, they've got to make a decision as to whether or not your faith is going to be their faith. You know, just like Gene was saying about husbands with non-Christian wives or vice versa. You know, I don't think, after they've heard it for the first 14 or 15 years of their life, I don't think, you know, jamming it down that much more is going to necessarily win the case. So that's the hardest part of giving responsibility. Maybe you need to say things like, as long as you are in this home, these are the rules. And I think that's a fair thing because you are the ones who are in charge and responsible for them. But I would say don't be excessive, and especially don't try to force them into situations like heavy-duty discipleship groups that they have no interest in at all. Third thing, honesty. Two members of our church were driving down the street, a mother and her teenage son, age about 14. It was a cold day, so I was standing on the sidewalk. I could see, even though the windows were closed because it was cold, I could see that the mother and the son were having a rather heated discussion. Rather heated discussion. And I was a little bit concerned because it was a family that I thought was pretty good. You know, things were going pretty well. So 2 days later, I saw the kid, let's call him Ken. I saw him in the youth group, and I said to him, saw you driving through town the other day with your mother. He says, yeah, yeah. Looked like you were having a pretty big fight about something. What was going on? And he goes, oh, yeah, we were having a discussion. I said, ooh, discussion, huh? And he said, yeah, we were discussing that whether or not Christians should dance. And I was discussing the fact that, hey, I think Christians should dance, and my mother was saying that they shouldn't dance. And so we were having sort of an argument about it. And I said, well, you know, what did you decide? And well, we decided together that it's a pretty tough issue and we have to do some more thinking and talking about it. Third quality is honesty. See, parents, that mother, I give her credit because she didn't come down with a cut and dried, black and white, neat and tidy solution. Because there are a lot of gray areas in life. And I can guarantee you, if your teenager is interested in one of those gray areas, whether it be social drinking or dancing or something else, they will find every verse in the Bible that defends their viewpoint. All right? Verses in the Bible that unless you start getting the scissors out and cutting them out, you're going to have to deal with. Jesus did not make the water into grape juice. You know? So how are you going to explain that to your Baptist kids? You know? I mean, you say, it was a mistake. Scratch, you know, cut out John chapter 2. Well, honesty. If you're going to build honesty in your kids, one of the principal things to remember is that you've got to tell them some of the hard issues of life. You've got to be willing to talk about those things. Things are just not that easy. I appreciate Gene's answers to questions, and those are the ways you need to answer some of your teenage questions. Some of them are cut and dried. Stop doing that. But others of them, you know, if you say to your teenage son that the way to victory over lust is just to read more of the scriptures, and that anybody who's really following the Lord wouldn't think that way. Well, that's a little bit of a neat and tidy solution, don't you think? You know, or when something catastrophic happens, usually in most teenagers' lives, one or two kids will die in their high school, and they will be confronted with the issue of death, and not only death, but the issue of death for someone who doesn't deserve to die. You know, I've seen whole high schools preoccupied with one kid who was dying from cancer. You know, and I think teenagers should come to grips with it. But if you just give the neat and tidy solution, you know, like, well, God knows why all these things are happening. All things work together for good. And you just quote a few verses and expect it to be sort of, you know, nice veneer put over the top. Boy, I think you're giving your teenager a disservice. Sometimes you need to sit down and say, we don't know why God lets some things happen. Sometimes, you know, can you imagine talking with your 17-year-old son and saying, you know, son, sometimes I feel like bagging the faith too. It's not easy to be a Christian. 2 weeks ago, I spoke to our high school Sunday school class, and forgive me for those of you who are in the seminar earlier today for repeating this, but I told them, I said, you know, if you want to have the maximum fun, don't follow Jesus. You follow Jesus because he is the truth. You follow Jesus because he is the way. You follow Jesus because he is the life. No one comes to the Father but through him. But if you want maximum fun, go get drunk. Short term, that's a lot more fun than a prayer meeting. And if you don't think that, your teenager does. You know, you've got to be honest with him. You say, you know, son, commitment to Jesus Christ is a commitment. It's not just, you know, a sugar coating for life. And I think a lot of teenagers, I think teenagers can accept that kind of Christianity. I think they have a hard time with, you know, the super high-powered, everything's a blessing Christianity. That's just a sort of an editorial comment. Honesty. Struggle with the hard questions. You need to understand, another thing regarding honesty, you need to understand their curiosity about life. In the book, again, Private Life of the American Teenager, one girl who was confused about sex and sexual terms was asked the question, why don't you ever talk to your mother about this? She goes, well, I'm curious about birth control techniques, but if I asked my mother, she'd say, you must be having sex. Why? Did she not talk to her mother? Maybe she thinks, oh, this is too much for mom to take. A lot of teenagers do think that way, you know. I don't want to bring this up with my mother. You know, she couldn't take it. And I've seen parents, and I've seen the way they've reacted. Teenager was right. They couldn't take it. You need to understand that sometimes they're just curious about life. They're asking questions. Sometimes they'll ask questions to sort of get your dander up, too. You know, teenagers are not stupid. They say, you know, I think this question will really throw mom and dad for a loop. You know, and it will, many times. And you say, what I would ask, especially kids in the youth group, what I'll ask is, why are you asking that question? You know, are you asking that because you want an answer, or are you asking that just to see what I'm going to say? Sometimes they'll tell me the truth, and sometimes they'll wait for the answer. Another thing about honesty is that you need to be discerning yourselves. Hebrews 5:14. Solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, have had their senses trained to discern good and evil. Discernment. If you're going to be honest in giving the straight truth about being a Christian in a secularized world, being a Christian in a world that is just flooded by the values that come out of the TV and the movie screens, then you've got to be a discerning person yourself. A young fellow in our youth group by the name of Howard was very much into rock music. His mother came to me quite distraught. You know, what am I going to do with Howard? I'm afraid that if he listens to this music, he's going to not only follow some of the lyrics, but he's going to get into the lifestyle of the people that are singing the songs, and I'm really concerned. Now, I thought, you know, it was a pretty legitimate concern. Howard hadn't done anything drastic. He didn't have any pierced ears or any, you know, hair down the center or anything like that. But, you know, it was a legitimate concern, so I told him that I'd talk to Howard. So So I talked to Howard. Howard said this, "I'm really concerned about my mother." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, she's addicted to soap operas. And I'm really concerned that she's going to adapt the lifestyle and the promiscuity that's expounded in those soap operas." I said, good point, Howard. So the moral of the story is, if you're going to be honest with your teenagers, you've got to be honest with yourselves. If you're going to be discerning with your teenagers, you've got to be discerning with yourselves. In that case, Howard and the mother talked, the three of us talked together, and the mother agreed to abolish her soaps if he agreed to cut down his rock and roll. And they did. And I think her honesty in admitting the fact that, hey, maybe I've been sucked in, was what Howard needed. He needed some consistency. You know, just like the story that was shared about the kid throwing the brick through the candy store window. You know, "I know my dad, and I know he won't like it." Well, that was communicated somehow in the family situation. But try to have some clear rules and guidelines. Anything concerning, you know, behavior in the home. Let's say, for example, at age 16 to 17, your kids decide that they want to smoke cigarettes. Now, I'm not trying to be despairing to you, but chances are you can't stop them. You know, I'm just being realistic. If they want to smoke, you're going to have a hard time stopping them. So you make the rule, no smoking in our home. All right? At least they get a feeling, you know, you can at least trust them. If they can't handle that rule, then you can, you know, say to them, "Hey, how can I trust you if you can't even hold?" That's just a little rule, relatively speaking. Clear rules and guidelines. Second thing, reward trust that is kept. Reward trust that is kept. A frequent criticism of teenagers is something like this: "I never hear anything from my parents except when I do something wrong." And it needs to be, when I say rewarding trust that is kept, I'm talking about affirmation. It's worthwhile for a dad to come down and hug his son or his daughter and say, "You're a good kid. That's enough. You don't have to say much else." You know, or your mother and daughter or mother and son sitting together, you know, "I'm glad to have you around the house. You're pretty nice." You know, do you say that kind of stuff to your kid? Because when you affirm them, when you reward the trust that is kept, it builds better credibility so that you can say something when something goes wrong. The books by Ross Campbell, How to Really Love Your Child and How to Really Love Your Teenager, talks a lot about this kind of affirmation and love, and especially love from the fathers to the children, which is one of the more difficult areas. You know, my kids know that I love them. They don't usually know unless you tell them. Trust. Reward trust that is kept. And affirm the kids when they are being good, not just when they are messing up. Third thing, if you want to build trust in the home, you should be trustworthy. You should be trustworthy, meaning keep your word, both good and bad. If you say you're going to punish in this way when something gets broken and they do break the rule and you don't punish, then in a sense the rule is not trustworthy, and you aren't either. If you say, "I'm going to be at your gymnastics meet, I'm going to be at your play," then be there. Be there. And if you're not there, you've communicated something that may be hard to backtrack on. Fourth thing relates to the final quality, and that is, when a trust is broken, you've got to forgive and try to give the trust back again. Because in a sense, trust is not just an earned commodity, trust is a gift. And believe me, your kids, you will trust them, and sometimes they will make mistakes. But unless you want to keep them locked up in a box until they graduate high school, or unless you want to plug up the cork in the hole, you know, you're going to have to give it to them again. There's an interesting rule, I think published by the insurance people, that says if you've had a car accident, the best thing to do is to go out right away and drive again. If you get thrown from a horse, the best thing to do is get back on the horse and ride again. If you blow it, you've got to give the kid the ability to rise again and walk. But let's talk about forgiveness, the final quality. Some of you are old enough to remember the song by the Beatles in the 1960s called "She's Leaving Home." It was on the album, I think, Sgt. Pepper's, and in that song, the Beatles sang about a girl who ran away from home, presumably a teenager or a rebellious kid at least. In it, the parents have two different responses about the teenage rebellion, the teenage misbehavior. The mother says these words, "How can she treat us so thoughtlessly? Why would she do this to me?" Total concern for the mother was, it's going to look so bad in the neighborhood. The father, apathetic, doesn't say anything, you know, let's go downstairs and have breakfast. Doesn't care, doesn't want to address, let's just leave it, let her run. Tired of having a teenager around. But the proper response is neither of those things. The proper response is forgiveness. Most difficult, especially in light of the fact of how much pain your teenagers can cause you. The average teenager does not understand a mother's worry. The average teenager does not understand the painful words that they can say, the harsh things. As you know, they can think and they can speak and they can tear you down. And man, it hurts. I was sharing earlier this today in a seminar on developing youth potential. I was talking about losing my hair. And there is an element, I'll speak to you fathers who might be losing your hair for a minute. There's an element where it might not bother you and you can talk about it with your wife or something like that. But when your kid comes up to you and pats you on the head, you know, or something like that. I mean, it's sort of insulting. Maybe it's a good humor, but if you've had a bad day, that could really drive you up a wall. You know? Or if you're putting on a few pounds. You know? I remember a while ago there was I used to do this with my father actually. There was a commercial on Alka-Seltzer. No matter what shape your stomach is in, I don't know if you remember it, but there was this huge pot belly, and there was this guy standing there like this, poking his finger, you know. So you walk in, and hey, Dad, how's the day? Bing, bing, bing. Well, you know, as much as that might be a humorous teenage thing to do, it gets to you. Because you're a human being. One of the things that I tell our kids is, I said, be understanding of your parents. This is their first time through life. You know? They've never been there before either. You know, I said, every day, it's not like this is their second time through. You know, I said, they're making decisions for the first time too. Oh, yeah. You know, and I tell the kids how much it might hurt them. But for you, the parent, that doesn't necessarily always help because not all of your kids are in my youth group and because of the fact that your kids don't always listen even if they were in my youth group. So how do you build forgiveness or the quality of forgiveness in the home? Let me just make three suggestions. First one is, to ask forgiveness. Learn to ask it. Teenagers, I am convinced, will be more free to fail in their homes if their parents have set the example of failing. Have you ever yelled at your kid without justification? Have you ever blown a thing out of proportion? Have you ever had a bad day and taken it out on your kid? Well, maybe you need to go and say, you know, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And don't just say, I'm sorry. Say, please forgive me, because that demands a response. That demands the teenager to release you. It's a quality of relationship that has to build so that you can let them know that you will forgive them, which is the second point. You ask forgiveness, number one. Second point under the forgiveness is you need to forgive and forget. A teenage girl was in high school, became a Christian at age 16. After she became a Christian, she wanted to go to her parents and share with them some of the things that she had done wrong. She wanted to confess her sins and be released. So she goes to her mother and she said, Mom and Dad, one of the things that I did wrong was, well, you know the household books that we keep? And they used to have these little envelopes in their house where, you know, you'd put in dollars or $10. And, well, sometimes I would steal money out of that. It was only, you know, a dollar here and a dollar there, but I would steal money out of the household books. So the parents, you know, and they absorbed it all and they said they forgave her and all that. A year, 2 years later, the girl was in a bad car accident. Actually, it's a year later. She was age 17. She was in a very bad car accident, and as a result of some insurance monies, received over $5,000 from the insurance company, above and beyond the cost of the accident. When she graduated high school, she was getting ready for college and asked her parents, where is that money? And the parents said, well, it's in a bank account. And as she looked at the bank book, her name was not on it. 2 years after she had asked for forgiveness, they came right out and told her, when she asked, you know, why is my name not on it? They said, well, remember you told us that story about stealing the money out of the household books. Well, we just didn't want to, you know, have the money all be gone and have you be over in Africa someplace. Now, regardless of the wisdom of the parents' perceived decision, they burn their daughter bad because they said they forgave her, but they weren't willing to wipe the slate clean. They weren't willing to forget. Take another situation, for example, a better situation. A mother and her teenage son and their young, his young brother, who's age 5, is in a department store. The mother has to go do an errand. The teenage son and the 5-year-old are walking around together, and the mother says to the teenage son, "You take care of Junior." And so he says, "Right on, we'll do." So Junior, 5 years old, is starting to walk around, and teenage son gets preoccupied at some display, video display or something like that. Well, within 5 minutes, where is Junior? Mother comes back from her errand, finds the teenage son. Where's Junior? I lost him. The mother, you know, gets mad, and the son legitimately says, "I'm really sorry, Mom, I blew it." Okay, the mother says, "Let's go to the counter." They call and they find the kid. And the mother says this, "Now I've got to do another errand. I want you to try again." See, that's forgiveness. That's forgetting. Because unless you're willing to give your kids those second chances, they're going to be living with this cloud over them. God removes our sins from us as far as the east is from the west. That's 2 points that we'll never meet. If you keep going east and east and east and east, you will never get west. You know, you can't meet in those 2 points. That's infinitely far apart from each other. God forgets our sins. He remembers them no more. And as hard as it is as human beings, we've got to try to do the same. Ask God for the grace to do the same. Forgive and forget. Third and final thing about forgiveness. Learn to forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. What were you like as a teenager? Whatever you did worst as a teenager, you will have an inclination, a tendency to want to blame that on your own kids. Let me just give you a personal example. If I were to have teenage kids right now, I would be always suspicious of them lying to me. You know why? Because I lied to my parents a lot. And what happens is that we do what psychologists call projection. We don't want them to go through the rocky road that we went through. We don't want them to make the same mistakes that we made, so we overcompensate. The parents who might have fooled around sexually before they were married will be overprotective, trying to guard their kids from any kind of sexual activity. The parents who did some stealing will be overly aware of the fact that their kids could be stealing. But you need to forgive yourself, because until you forgive yourself and any mistakes that you might have made in your pre-Christian or even after you became a Christian teen years, until you forgive yourself, your kid, in some respects, will not be freed up to grow themselves. Forgiveness. It doesn't mean excusing the kid's behavior. It means it goes along with responsibility. You know, if they burn you, you've got to forgive them, but there might be consequences. You know, if you tell them that they shouldn't drive the car yet because they don't have their license, and they get in and they're fooling around and they back the car through the garage door, well, taking the money out of their allowance doesn't necessarily mean you haven't forgiven them. You can forgive them for what they did and still make them understand that what they did has consequences. Okay, so not, when I say forgiveness, I do not mean license. I do not mean just saying, you know, "Oh, go do whatever you want and I'll forgive you." That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about legitimately forgiving them to give them a fresh start. Respect, responsibility, honesty, trust, forgiveness. It's the best places for us to start as parents, as workers with youth, as teenagers ourselves, building those things integrally into the family unit so that everybody can grow. Let me pray. Lord, we thank you for the challenge that you've given us in terms of growing. For those who are teenagers here today, I pray that you would help them to love and to grow with their parents. For parents, I pray that you would give them the perseverance, the understanding, the wisdom that they need to be good parents. And Lord, I pray that all of us, as we influence each other's lives, would have these same qualities in our relationships too, that we would all grow more into the person of Christ and that we would continue to see fruit in our own quality of lives because we're becoming more like Him. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.